Good day, everyone, and welcome to the DHS Progress Report conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. You may enter the question queue at any time during the conference by pressing star 1. Please note that this conference is being recorded. It's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mary Giovannoli. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mark. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this panel discussing the release of the Immigration Policy Center's second annual DHS Progress Report, an analysis of immigration policy in the second year of the Obama administration. I'm Mary Giovannoli, the director of the IPC here at the American Immigration Council. I'm joined today by my co-authors, Dr. Michelle Waslin, senior policy analyst at the IPC, and Travis Packer, an attorney and the IPC research and policy assistant, as well as Royce Murray, the co-author of our first report. Today, our call is being recorded for archival purposes, and our report is available as we speak on our website at www.immigrationpolicy.org. After some short presentations from our co-authors, we'll be happy to answer your questions. So let me begin with a brief overview. After 2 years in office, the Obama administration faces numerous immigration challenges, albeit some of their own making. With comprehensive immigration reform held hostage by Congress, the administration faces a challenge. How can it infuse the vision of a humane and just immigration system that President Obama has so eloquently called for in the context of a system that is itself no longer fully functioning? During the transition period for the Obama administration, numerous experts and advocates recommended a dual approach. Comprehensive immigration reform in Congress for the broad systemic changes that require legislative action, but a robust administrative reform strategy that makes full use of executive branch authority to ensure that discretion and good judgment ruled in the exercise of administrative functions. Our first DHS report, issued last March, tracked many of those early recommendations, finding that there was great enthusiasm to shift some priorities and more fully engage the public within DHS, but at the same time, a disturbing tendency to rely on enforcement-driven strategies as a way to prove that the administration was sufficiently enforcement-minded to justify transitioning to CIR. This year, our report finds that this tendency has turned into a dogged insistence that the administration's hands are tied without congressional action, a conclusion which is unwarranted, given the wide range of executive branch authority available to DHS and the president, and short-sighted in an era where Congress seems ill-equipped to govern the nation, fixated on budget battles and posturing. How does this play out in practice? My co-authors are going to share with you some of the details of our research, which we found is best understood through the lens of key themes that were actually suggested by DHS itself in its public documents and comments: prioritization, transparency, and coordination. But at the same time, I want to share with you a few of our top-line conclusions. Our findings led to three significant conclusions and a range of recommendations for perfecting the good and reforming the less than satisfactory aspects of DHS performance. Generally, we find that DHS gets mixed reviews, largely because it's suffering from some fundamental flaws in the direction immigration policy is taking. First, by assuming that CIR would and could solve all the agency's woes, there's been an insufficient attention paid to reforming DHS from within. Because of this mindset, the three immigration agencies, ICE, CBP, and USCIS, continue to operate on separate planes with insufficient coordination and increasingly differing approaches to the same issue or case. There's also a lack of leadership internally at DHS, which simply has no structure through an undersecretary for immigration or other political decision maker to maintain the necessary coordination and control. Most disturbing, DHS officials at the highest levels seem afraid to exercise their powers to improve the system, fearing congressional responses or perhaps even political backlash. A series of leaked memos last year, which proposed administrative reforms that did not require congressional action, were buried, denied, and ultimately disavowed, as Secretary Napolitano repeatedly noted that her job was to enforce the law, and her department had deported more people than ever before. This unnecessary emphasis on deportation as the key method for enforcing the law is at the heart of many of the troubling factors that we find this year. Real change is possible, but it requires the Obama administration and DHS to embrace the tools available to ameliorate some of the worst consequences of failing in inadequate laws. In fact, as the executive branch, it's their responsibility to do so. our recommendations, which you can see in more detail in our report and that we'll discuss more fully during this conference call, include a renewed commitment to prosecutorial discretion and other executive branch authority, further expansion of efforts to engage and involve the public in immigration policymaking, continued support for programs such as citizenship and integration training that work, and a rejection of this mindset that deportation is the natural consequence of enforcing the law. With this in mind, let's turn to a closer examination of some of the highs and lows of the last year. We'll go to Dr. Michelle Wasland, a senior policy analyst here at the Immigration Policy Center, for our first snapshot of DHS in the last year.
Thanks, Mary. I'm going to get us started by discussing the issue of prioritization. One of the challenges that DHS has faced is its multiple missions of enforcing the law and facilitating legal immigration. So admittedly, it's got to be difficult to be responsible for these very different and sometimes conflicting missions, especially given the complexity of immigration law and the fact that the laws are outdated and dysfunctional. However, many have observed that DHS prioritizes the deportation side over the immigration benefits side. If you look at DHS's own list of accomplishments in 2010, you'll see that it's all about enforcement along the border and in the interior, but it says very little about its accomplishments in the area of facilitating legal immigration. The rhetoric coming from the department and from the White House has increasingly been enforcement heavy, celebrating the record number of deportations, the expansion of the Secure Communities programs, and other enforcement measures without appropriately balancing enforcement with the rest of DHS's mandate. Within DHS, ICE has issued several significant memos that attempt to prioritize enforcement actions to target those immigrants who are serious criminals and pose a threat to society. While these memos were couched in arguments that resources permitted the deportation of no more than 400,000 immigrants per year, they also alluded to the importance of humanitarian concerns when evaluating decisions to put someone in proceedings. So while these prioritization memos are definitely a step forward, the reality is that many immigrants who are not dangerous criminals continue to be detained and deported every day. One of the primary reasons is that ICE is relying on its partnerships with state and local police agencies, partnerships like the 287G program and the Secure Communities program, which really leave it up to the local police to funnel immigrants from the justice system, the criminal justice system, into the immigration system. And data from these programs is included in the report, and this data shows that they're far from being targeted programs, that they've identified unacceptably large numbers of non-priority immigrants. But it's also true that while the local police are identifying all of these non-criminals, non-priorities, ICE doesn't have to deport every single person that local police identify. ICE really has the ability to stick to their own priorities by issuing detainers and taking action only on those people who are determined to be serious criminals. But ICE has not yet issued final detainer guidance that reflects the agency's priorities. And ICE continues to detain and deport immigrants who have been charged or convicted of misdemeanors or other less serious crimes or people who have no criminal history at all. When we look at worksite enforcement, ICE has definitely shifted its emphasis away from the large-scale raids of the Bush administration, and it's now conducting large numbers of I-9 audits that target employers who commit egregious violations of immigration law. And this is definitely laudable. But we also know that many employers who don't fit the target are being hit with audits. Some are good employers that have a unionized workforce and pay decent wages, yet they have been forced to fire large portions of their workforce. But meanwhile, we know that there are unscrupulous employers who are exploiting and abusing their workforce, and they're not being targeted for audits. Let's turn to USCIS briefly. The priority at USCIS continues to be the delivery of immigration services. In many areas, the agency got high marks. In the past year, USCIS granted refugee status to the highest number of refugees in over a decade. It issued an unprecedented number of U visas. These are visas for victims of crime. And USCIS contributed tremendous support toward citizenship education and preparation programs by offering over $8 million to 56 organizations nationwide through its Citizenship and Integration Grant Program. However, our report also makes it clear that there are still concerns about USCIS prioritizing enforcement and fraud detection over providing immigration benefits. At a recent press conference on strategic goals and initiatives, USCIS itself listed strengthening national security safeguards within the immigration system and combating fraud as its top priorities. That is, not ensuring U.S. citizens and legal immigrants receive their visas and other services in an efficient manner. Applications for green cards, naturalization, and any other benefits are being more closely scrutinized by DHS, which means more delays. Applicants are being asked for additional documentation and information to support their visa applications, often excessively so, and without any reason for the additional requests provided. These delays affect families who seek to be united with their loved ones and businesses whose employees can't quickly get the clearance they need to come to the United States to work and contribute to our economy. Finally, our report looks at CBP. Even though its primary function is definitely immigration enforcement, it has managed to even expand that role. Even if a foreigner has a visa, it's CBS's role to grant admission to that person. So when the person arrives at the border, the port of entry, with a visa, CBP still has to grant admission to that person. However, advocates along the border are reporting that CBP is going well beyond that traditional role of granting admission, and it's looking to the merits of the underlying visa petition, and in some cases, overturning the decisions that were made by other agencies within DHS that granted that visa. So the problem is that CBP officers are not trained in these complex areas of visa requirements. That's not what they do typically. For example, in some cases, CBP has questioned business travelers, detailed questions about their employers, but the CBP officer doesn't know the specifics of the particular visa, and they're asking inappropriate questions, and the traveler certainly doesn't have all of the documentation that they had when they were filling out their visa application, and they can't answer CBP's questions because they might not have that extensive knowledge of the employer that petitioned for them. So we have reports that CBP officers believe that in this economy, they're now the protectors of the U.S. economy. And by letting foreign workers in, they believe that they're taking jobs away from U.S. workers. So, again, that's a great expansion of the role of CBP along the border. Overall, in conclusion, prioritization of resources and objectives often gets more lip service within DHS, particularly its enforcement functions, than we see on the ground. There's a lot of talk about priorities, but in reality, we haven't seen the impact of that prioritization. So marrying priorities and practice, therefore, remains a significant challenge for DHS.
Thank you very much, Michelle. As I said, the report this year looks at the tries to analyze DHS through three different frames, and the second frame is transparency. Travis Packer, who is an attorney here at the Immigration Policy Center and our research and policy assistant, is going to delve into that a little bit more deeply, particularly as it relates to detention-related issues.
Thank you, Mary. As DHS priorities are being formulated, challenged, and reevaluated under the Obama administration, the department's decision-making processes become increasingly critical. We asked a number of questions in the report, including, do stakeholders understand how and why policies are being made? Does the department seek and incorporate meaningful input from field officers and advocates who engage with DHS policies on a day-to-day basis? And do stakeholders know how to access these processes for voicing their concerns? So what did we find? Overall, DHS does an adequate job of engaging communities, but with varying outcomes. While USCIS and ICE have made some strides in their efforts to increase transparency, Customs and Border Protection largely continues to keep itself inaccessible in its decision-making behind closed doors. USCIS continues to lead the way in providing opportunities for stakeholders to engage and comment on agency actions. This past year, it initiated a new program that allows the public to comment on draft memos before they are put into effect, which is an exciting opportunity for the public to help shape policy. The challenge for USCIS going forward will be to use these comments in a meaningful way. ICE has also strengthened its stakeholder engagement in 2010, at least at the national level. In particular, its working groups which meet with various immigration advocates represent an increased effort at transparency. Advocates generally appreciate these working group meetings as opportunities to relay questions and concerns to the agency and to hear from agency officials. However, advocates sometimes question the sincerity of ICE's efforts to be transparent and the impact that the advocates' feedback has on policymaking. Of course, one obstacle is that many advocates question DHS's overall strategy with respect to immigration enforcement. It's difficult to have meaningful dialogue about the specifics of how policies are implemented when there is little buy-in from the advocacy community to the notion that immigration enforcement must be prioritized and expanded. Despite a philosophical disagreement about the scope of immigration enforcement, the ICE working groups have led to some positive steps over the past year. These positive steps include the implementation of the online detainee locator system, which allows families and legal representation to locate their loved ones and clients through an easily accessible online form. However, the creation of the risk assessment tool, which would determine eligibility for release from detention, highlights both the positive and negative effects of ICE's transparency. While advocates had input into the tool, it has faced severe delays in implementation. Currently, ICE states that the tool is being automated and will be implemented in January 2012. This may, in the end, be a positive step, but advocates have not seen the latest version of the tool being automated, and with tools like these, the devil is in the details. Finally, Secure Communities is a program that appears to intentionally operate behind a veil of bureaucracy and secrecy, generating serious questions about who will really be targeted and whether and how localities can decline to participate in the program. This is important because DHS has said that Secure Communities will be operational in every single jurisdiction in the country in 2013. Yet communities have had very little information about the program. In the past year, DHS has released conflicting information about whether communities could opt in or out of Secure Communities, and recent information released under a Freedom of Information Act request suggests that there was a deliberate effort to keep the public from fully understanding this option. Next, I wanted to say a little bit about Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. For purposes of contrast, I've talked a little bit about ICE's working groups, yet Customs and Border Protection has no working groups with immigrant advocates. CBP has made some small efforts to meet with the Private Attorneys Bar through twice-yearly meetings with the American Immigration Lawyers Association CBP Committee, and met with immigrant advocates for the first time in 2.5 years in March. Despite these small steps, problems with transparency continue to plague CBP. Few outside the agency understand CBP's priorities or processes, and advocates and DHS officials alike report that CBS is loath to go on record about its policies and procedures. For example, although other agencies have published their operations manuals, such as the USCIS Adjudicator's Field Manual and ICE's Detention and Removal Officer's Field Manual, CBP will not publish its Inspector's Field Manual. This refusal to publish the Inspector's Field Manual and other important policy documents online disregards instructions from President Obama, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Attorney General to make efforts to improve agency transparency. In conclusion, the stakeholders' meetings with ICE and USCIS have increased the level of transparency and communication between the agencies and advocates. Information has been shared on a regular basis, and these agencies take the time to listen to the advocates' questions and concerns, and they have made adjustments to their plans based on immigrant advocates' input. However, because of the limited scope of these meetings, other issues such as a reduction in overall detention numbers and the detention of immigrants who do not need to be detained are not on the table. CBP's overall efforts at transparency are lacking, to say the least. Future progress relies not only on the continuation of current dialogues and the creation of new ones, but on openness on the part of DHS to reconsider policy positions currently set in stone. Thank you.
Thank you, Travis. And so on the one hand, we see that there is a growing engagement, at least among ICE and certainly among USCIS, with the public. And there are benefits that come from those relationships. But let's turn the tables inward a little bit and ask, what are the relationships like within DHS, at least in terms of what we were able to uncover in our report? And for that, we're going to turn to Royce Bernstein-Murray, who's capable of writing and thinking about these kinds of issues because she's a former Associate General Counsel in INS and in United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. And Royce is also an independent consultant on human rights and immigration law and currently teaches at the University of the District of Columbia. So Royce, what are your thoughts on coordination?
Sure. Thanks, Mary, and good afternoon, everyone. The third theme, as Mary said, that we addressed in this report was coordination, and we looked at how well the immigration agencies coordinated their actions and policies and whether they were able to promote department-wide consistency. We also assessed the leadership offered by the department to facilitate this process. Inevitably, this theme of coordination overlaps the other themes discussed by Michelle and Travis. Although ICE, USCIS, and CBP have distinct missions, we looked at whether they agree on what the immigration priority should be. Do they coordinate among one another to determine their priorities and make sure that they're not working at cross purposes? And does DHS provide critical leadership to make sure that the agencies are pursuing consistent goals? Likewise, are these deliberations transparent so that the public understands the department's reasoning and can offer input on policies and practices? As Mary said at the outset of the call, our findings on these issues were mixed. Interagency coordination continues to present a major challenge to DHS 8 years after its creation. The department is structurally flawed. The three immigration agencies are designed to act completely independently with no meaningful resource mechanism for coordinated decision-making. Right now, the only coordinated authority over these agencies rests with Secretary Napolitano, who has over 200,000 employees and 21 agencies putting competing priorities on her plate, not just immigration. Although CBP, ICE, and USCIS have distinct missions, DHS has failed to provide the critical leadership and reporting structure needed to bridge the gaps and move forward with a coherent and unified agenda. DHS coordination is also desperately needed to avoid conflicting interpretations of law within and between agencies. Other conflicts occur when DHS does not provide the support to the agencies to withstand congressional attacks on matters within the discretion of the executive branch, such as administrative reform of certain immigration practices. The lack of coordination also has led to uneven and inconsistent application of information sharing practices, defying many of the Obama administration directives to cut red tape and provide the public easy access to information. Among the areas where leadership and coordination is needed most is the DHS regulatory process, which is impossible to navigate and has come to a virtual standstill. Without a working, streamlined regulatory review process, implementing laws and holding the agencies accountable for their actions becomes ever more difficult. In the face of this challenge, we acknowledge USCIS in the report, pointing out that its memo and policy review processes have been a good way to review and issue needed guidance that can be done without promulgating a regulation. The report also presents two case studies of the Refugee and Asylum Program and DHS initiatives related to Haiti. We examine the themes discussed today of prioritization, transparency, and coordination as they presented themselves in these two areas, Refugee and Asylum Program and Haiti. And I'll briefly highlight some of the coordination issues that we identified. On a positive note, we saw some real progress made by the White House-led interagency working group addressing issues related to terrorism-related inadmissibility grounds, also known as TRIG. As you all may know, the terrorism-related provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act are worded and applied broadly with refugees and asylees, and the system is otherwise designed to protect them, so refugees and asylees are disproportionately affected by the application of these terrorism-related grounds. Many of their benefit and adjustment applications sit on hold for months or years, waiting for exemptions and waivers. To its credit, the Interagency Working Group has been steadily identifying groups and actions that would not be subject to TRIG, and we realize that some of the hardest work lies ahead, but encourage the interagency to keep up the good work. Haiti, on the other hand, provides a good example of where interagency coordination fell short. Just 1 year ago, DHS had quickly responded to the earthquake in Haiti, announcing the TPS, temporary protected status, designation, and other temporary benefits for Haitians already in the United States. USCIS, in turn, made great strides with extensive public engagement to the Haitian community and later addressed concerns about the application process. In recent months, as USCIS was preparing to implement the Help Haiti Act for evacuated orphans, and they were reaching the final stretch of TPS registration, which is typically when most nationals of a TPS-designated country tend to register, ICE announced a policy to resume deportations to Haiti. There was no formal written announcement of deportation criteria until the public outcry ensued. ICE moved ahead with its first plane load of deportees in January, and had one deportee die of cholera-like symptoms just a couple of weeks later. It was only after the fact that ICE issued a draft written removals policy for Haiti, and despite a great deal of public comment, they continue to pursue removals to Haiti. Now we'll have to wait and see if implementation of their final policy is consistent with the priorities they identified, focusing on serious criminal aliens, or whether planes will also be filled with non-criminals or those whose minor offenses were committed long ago. This lack of a disciplined and coordinated approach to issues seems to routinely undermine the good work that does happen within the agencies. Finally, I'll add that the Secretary of DHS must empower political appointees at the headquarters level with the necessary operational control over the agencies. Whether that authority is vested in the Office of Policy or elsewhere, there must be DHS officials who can ensure that the immigration agencies are both coordinating and in compliance with the policies and expectations of the department. We would also recommend that immigration reporting and command functions within the department be reorganized to ensure that the key point person on immigration is empowered to block operational decisions that are inconsistent with department policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. So you can see that for every challenge, there are also great opportunities, and that we hope that this report will actually provide a forum for people in the government, for people on the Hill, and the public to discuss what our immigration policy really should be and how we can best accomplish that, particularly through administrative change. So, Mark, if you'd like to open the line up to calls now, we'd be happy to take your questions.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your phone. That is star and one. You may remove yourself from the question queue by pressing the pound key, and we will allow a moment for questions to queue.
While we're waiting for questions, Royce, I have one for you. You and I have both been through INS and DHS, and I'm just curious, do you ever in any way long for the days of INS when you look at DHS sometimes?
I do from the perspective that we were far more integrated at that time, as much as DHS was created to in part enable the separate immigration agencies to handle their functions independently, there was a level of integration beforehand that doesn't appear to exist at this time. Things are far more siloed than they ever were before.
Thank you. I understand we have questions now, Mark.
Yes. Pardon me. Yes, we will go first to the side of Peter Schrag with California Progress. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. This question is addressed primarily to Michelle, but maybe to others as well. As I read the report and hear your comments, my sense is, and this is, of course, especially true to the prioritization issue, is that to some extent now, the tail of the states is wagging the dog of the federal government. Am I misreading that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of back and forth, right? To some extent, it's the failure of the federal government, the failure of Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform that's led to this increased frustration and pressure at the state and local level. So we have seen the passage of local ordinances and state laws aimed at controlling immigration. And that, in turn, I believe, puts more pressure on the federal government. And, you know, again, rather than passing comprehensive immigration reform, which is really what we need, we have seen an increase in this focus on enforcement and this attempt to deport as many people as possible and put as much money and personnel and resources at the border as possible. So I think it's a vicious circle there.
Well, is it? But partly through 287G and through secure communities and through the states, in fact, are in a way driving federal policy. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that that's a very good point. The fact is that by entering into these partnerships with state and local police, that means that the state and local police are identifying large numbers of people that have been arrested and funneling them into the immigration system. So ICE has been made aware of many more people that have been arrested by or detained by state and local jails. So that really puts an additional strain on ICE's resources. They have, you know, a much larger pool of people that has been identified to them. And that's where prioritization really should come into play, right? That ICE has limited resources and they have set these priorities. They said they're going to focus on people who are serious, dangerous criminals, a threat to the community. A lot of people who have no criminal convictions, who have been picked up for a traffic stop, et cetera, are being made known to ICE. So ICE really has to make this decision. Are we going to try to get everybody, or are we going to do what we're saying we're going to do, and are we going to prioritize which people we actually take action on? And unfortunately, up to this point, we have really seen ICE going after everybody, from what the statistics tell us, that they haven't really focused on the most serious criminals. So you're right that there is additional pressure on ICE's resources and priorities from these partnerships with state and local police agencies.
Thanks.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one. And we will go next to the side of David Montero with the Salt Lake Tribune. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, it's for Wendy. Utah, obviously, has been in the news with it, what it did with the Utah Compact and passing a guest worker bill and an enforcement bill, trying to take a comprehensive approach. And our attorney general has actually been meeting with DHS officials to try and talk them or coax them into some kind of agreement to allow Utah to do this or to drive the immigration debate forward into beyond enforcement only. Can you get a sense of what Utah is doing and what has happened and how that is affecting this dynamic now within DHS? And is it changing anything? Is it changing the conversation at all?
Well, I think that this is Mary from the IPC. I think it takes a while for the conversation to change in DHS, to be honest. I think that right now the issue really is how do you balance, I think, the attempt that Utah has made to recognize that we need to do more than try to just enforce our way out of the situation with the clear dilemma that you know, as a former government official, I'm pretty confident they're seeing, which is that the proposals for guest worker programs in Utah are themselves either unlawful or unconstitutional in terms of the ability to actually enforce them. So I think, if anything, what it really can do and what I think we should celebrate in the way that Utah has handled this issue is that it does open the door to discuss, isn't it time to change the debate? But I think for the most part, DHS continues to view that as a debate that has to take place, in Congress, and is not yet ready to really engage on the ways that it might be able to change at least some of the dynamic through regulations and broader policy determinations, and some of which certainly could address elements of business needs and issues.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one. That is star and one. And we will pause another moment for questions to queue. And it looks like we will go next to the site of Julian Resendez with Aldea. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. With the political season coming up in a few months, do you see any chance that the Obama administration will address this inconsistencies in what's being said and what's being done?
Well, we think it would actually be to their advantage to address these issues as we move closer and closer to the 2012 election. I think the importance of the Latino population and that vote is something that needs to be taken into account very seriously. And you would think that would help prompt more attention to immigration.
But I should say that I think that immigration itself, as with most issues, can be a driver and can be a reflection of what people are thinking. So it's important to understand that this is an issue that isn't just affecting the Latino population, but really immigrants across the country and virtually all of us, because of the impact that enforcement policies have on our economic bottom line and on the sort of social and cultural structure that we have. So I think that the more pressure that the Obama administration sees from a wide range of groups, the more likely it is that they'll be taking these things seriously. And the less pressure there is, the calculation may be that it isn't as important to the political consequences in 2012. Any other questions?
And we have no more questions in queue at this time.
Okay. Well, if we have no more questions, let me remind you that the report itself, which actually is quite long but has a great executive summary and can be read in its various and sundry chunks by theme or by topic or by agency, is available to you at www.immigrationpolicy.org. And if you have any further questions or wish to get a hold of any of the speakers, please feel free to contact our Director of Communications, Wendy Sefsaf, at 202-507-7524. Thank you so much for joining us today, and happy reading.